Daily Tradition List on Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 9th of November, 2017. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show today Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on yet again.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I do enjoy our podcast that we do together. And so do a lot of the listeners, as they do say in the comments, how much they enjoy the shows that have you on there, especially just because you're so knowledgeable about so many different subjects. And I think that's one of the best subjects that you're good at is history, and particularly Soviet history. And this is why I wanted to get you for today, is because we've had... Well, the White House, basically, they put out a statement on the 7th of November, and I didn't realize this until yesterday, but it's quite a remarkable statement to think that this came from the White House, basically, the Trump administration, and it's about communism. And I must apologize that we actually missed this on the 7th of November, but it was actually the National Day for the Victims of Communism. So I thought, well, we could talk a bit about communism today, and also just about this missive from the White House. And I'll read it out and then ask you for your comments on it, I think, Matt. And it says, today, the 7th of November, obviously not today, today's the 9th, the National Day for the Victims of Communism marks 100 years since the Bolshevik Revolution took place in Russia. The Bolshevik Revolution gave rise to the Soviet Union and its dark decades of oppressive communism, a political philosophy incompatible with liberty, prosperity, and the dignity of human life. Over the past century, communist totalitarian regimes around the world have killed more than 100 million people and subjected countless more to exploitation, violence, and untold devastation. These movements, under the false pretense of liberation, systematically robbed innocent people of their God-given rights of free worship, freedom of association, and countless other rights we hold sacrosanct. Citizens yearning for freedom were subjugated by the state through the use of coercion, violence, and fear. Today, we remember those who have died and all who continue to suffer under communism. In their memory and in honor of their indomitable spirit of those who have fought courageously to spread freedom and opportunity around the world, our nation reaffirms its steadfast resolve to shine the light of liberty for all who yearn for a brighter, freer future. Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
When I first read that, I could not believe it came from the White House. That's not the language of official American missives like that. It really isn't. The reference to God-given rights struck me the hardest. Nothing like that was even said during the Reagan administration. You may know that Putin has erected the monument or even a museum in Russia for the victims of Stalin. And so this seems to be a thing here. We're coming to the 100. I mean, the Bolsheviks really didn't take over fully until 1921. But we're at a time, 100 years, when, you know, the royal government was overthrown and the very weak provisional state took over. It's just not the language of official White House documents. And that's why I was so struck by it. We could have written something like that, you know. And yeah, despite all of our criticisms of the U.S., which in my case are endless, it is true that the U.S. hosted refugees from Marxism, like the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, in New York City. So there are some positive things. The Patriarch Mstislav of Ukraine testified at HUAC, something that few know about, talking about his experience. It's really an incredible thing, and I think it also has something to do with the Antifa violence and their romanticization of Marxism. I can just picture, you know, university professors' heads exploding, and that's enough for me.
Well, they're using terms like Bolshevik Revolution, which I can't recall ever hearing officials using words like that, calling them Bolsheviks. So they usually refer to the Russian Revolution or the Communist Revolution, and it does talk about communism here, and it talks about the 100 million victims of communism, which we just don't hear about. All we seem to hear about is the victims of the horrible Nazis. And of course, the Nazis the National Socialists were fighting against communism. That was the whole point of it. That was the whole point of the swastika, was that it made a vivid image to counteract the hammer and sickle. This is why all these Waffen-SS units volunteered, was to fight against communism. And yet today, it's the National Socialist symbols that are banned everywhere, and we see communist symbols popping up all over the place with the Antifa and their romanticization of the USSR. Interesting here as well, it doesn't say the Russian Revolution. It's saying it's the Bolshevik Revolution, like the Bolsheviks were somebody else. Now, most of our listeners are probably aware, Matt, that the Bolsheviks were Jews. But just how did this come about? How did these Jews manage to take over and start up this revolution? Did they start the revolution, or did they hijack the revolution, as some people seem to think?
No, this is the revolution, and even Winston Churchill will say this later, was an ethnic movement. Tsar Nicholas II was not an unpopular man. World War I was not an unpopular war, though it was near the end. But the exhaustion of the Russian people, especially after the Civil War, was such that they were willing to tolerate pretty much anything for the sake of peace. I do want to note, though, that low-level civil war occurred continuously in the USSR right up until World War II. That's proven by the fact that that there were these National Socialist communities, like I have, like Lokot, but I have a whole podcast on that, sprung up, and they were assisting German infantry with things Russian and with targets and things like that. They knew the lay of the land and everything, and cooperation between the Russians and the Germans was extraordinary there. And that makes Operation Keelhaul all the more tragic. I say, and Wills Cardo was the first one to say this to me, and I'll repeat it. Stalin was getting ready to invade Europe. The later dissident, Major General Peter Grigorenko, before he became a dissident, said that it was an offensive posture. 2.7 million Russian men were on the Western frontier in 1941. Well, there's no training facilities for there. There's no barracks for those guys. It had to have been very short term. What were they there for? They weren't there permanently. And yet huge numbers were being transferred there. But as far as, so Hitler saved Europe from Bolshevism, period.
So they were lining up there hoping to export this to the West, hoping to fought, and at least we didn't have this in Western Europe. But there's also a link between the USSR and the Bolshevik regime and the West, because Britain was allied with Stalin. So what was happening there? How come we were allied with Stalin? How come America was allied with Stalin? And yet today we've got we've got this, there were 100 million victims, and we need to have a national day of remembrance for them. How come there was this link there? How could they claim to be against communism and yet at the same time were allied with Stalin? What happened there, Matt?
That's one of the most frightening aspects of the 20th century. The greatest open secret of that century is that the Western world supported the Bolsheviks during the Civil War, built the Soviet economy, traded with them consistently right up until the end, then after World War II, rebuilt the Soviet economy. After World War II, the of course, as very famously, the U.S. had the Marshall Plan, The Soviets had rejected it on the grounds that it would mean that they would have to turn over their books. So the U.S. created another Marshall Plan, a separate plan. I can't think of the name off the top of my head. And that doesn't make it into the history books, but that's what rebuilt the USSR. Put it like this. The end of the Russian Civil War, say 1921-22. The men that you would need to run an industrial economy, all the intellectuals and scientists and engineers, were either dead, in exile, underground, or in prison. And yet, within 10 years, they were an industrial power. How can that possibly be? Well, there's only one answer, and that is because Western corporations built it. There was never any opposition to the Soviet Union. The Cold War is a myth. Any two strong powers are going to disagree on certain things. That doesn't make it a war. We never traded with the Germans during World War II. And yet during this Cold War, the U.S. Was trading regularly with the USSR. So as American soldiers are dying in Vietnam, North Vietnamese are getting weapons partially constructed in America. Throughout the Cold War, so-called Cold War, Russian scientists are being trained in American universities. Hundreds of them, in fact, coming back to the Soviet Union and teaching others. There was never a problem with this. There was never any condemnation of this. There were never any sanctions on the Soviet Union, but they are now, of course, on Russia. So there was never really any opposition. No one in Wilson's administration in the early years could tell you what Bolshevism was or what communism was. And it didn't bother them one way or the other. All they knew is that there was a stable Russia to counteract Germany, which is all they cared about. The British Empire was enthusiastic about the Soviet Union because it kept Germany at bay. And Hitler couldn't believe – Hitler is – he must have been just in disbelief that England was willing to sacrifice blood for the sake of supporting the USSR. And Hitler had no negative designs, no desire to conquer the British Empire. And so the reason that there's never really been any opposition, they've always been allies, is that there was too many American and Western investments in the USSR.
So the people at the top were working in tandem with them, and yet the population weren't told this, and the publicity about it was all these guys are the enemy. And that came after the Second World War, didn't it? Before then, there was a lot of publicity that was saying, oh, it was a workers' paradise. Russia is a workers' paradise. But the intelligence agencies knew different. I forget who it was, wasn't it? A well-known journalist that was in the Ukraine and saw the starvation that was going on and the cannibalism and all the horrific things that went on there and managed to smuggle this information out. It was up till that point that the newspapers had lied about this, where you had these connections between the newspaper owners and the people that were running the Bolshevik Revolution, the Jews. So you had the Jews owning the newspapers, the Jews running the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Jewish bankers financing it. And they all conspired to cover this up. But you still had intelligence agencies that knew what was going on, and yet the American and the British government ignored the intelligence agencies and carried on working with these people, working together, allying themselves with Stalin. And then after the war, this came out, and the public became aware of this. So you still had good Americans and good British people that were against communism, but at the same time, you had these other people in the administrations that were working with them. And I think the big surprise about this is that you've now got Donald Trump in there, who wasn't trained to be a politician from his early life, and now he's put out this statement, which is in line with the people that were duped by this and that thought that America was actually somehow fighting against Soviet Russia and fighting against the Soviets. So this is the surprising thing about this statement, I think, Matt, because it shows you that he's not one of these people that has been groomed from childhood to be a politician, because he clearly believes this, that America was against communism. America was the leader of the free world, something which the freed former Soviet states still look up to America as this beacon of freedom. I think most of them have now realize that it's actually a load of degeneracy. But all the while this was going on, the people that were in the Soviet bloc were looking to America as freedom and liberty. They just didn't realize what sort of freedom and liberty it was.
Well, there were legitimate disagreements, of course. But any two powers that size are going to disagree on things. You know, there was a Vietnam War, there was a Korean War, but that had nothing to do with ideology. There was no opposition to Bolshevism at all. And it seems that the only time you find American politicians getting upset about the Soviet Union is when they were acting like the czars. That's what Woodrow Wilson used to say, and his successors. That all of a sudden it became a problem only then, and that's the language that they used. When the Soviet Union was trying to create a trading bloc that didn't include the U.S., all of a sudden communism was evil. So there were disagreements, but it had nothing to do with Bolshevism, nothing to do with communism. It was just two strong powers vying for influence. But there was never any – the handful of people – you know, before the 1950s, no one in the West knew anything about Russia. There was one Russian language program, I think, in America, and that was at Harvard. It was just this big black spot on American life. They didn't know what was going on there. All they heard was that, you know, oh, there's a strong leader who's going to unify the country. So, therefore, they could counteract Germany, which is all anyone seemed to care about. And let me stress here that the White Army, according to Kolchak and so many others, didn't get a penny, didn't get a bullet from the Western world. That is a huge myth. Now, I have a book coming out on the Barnes Review, Revisionist Essays on the Soviet Union, explaining this in some depth. The British could have crushed the Soviets in St. Petersburg very, very quickly, and they didn't. The U.S. threatened the Japanese, who were in a position to destroy the Red Army during the Russian Civil War. And so they held back. The White Armies were running out of ammunition. Most of their weaponry came from taking it from dead Reds. And this is the reason they lost. I have Kolchak's memoirs here, and he says this is unbelievable. I don't think the West knows what they're supporting here. But there was not a bullet that was ever given to the White. But the White Armies had far more money than the Reds. The White Armies were better led than the Reds, and the White Armies had far more men than the Reds. And yet they still lost for that reason. They were running out of ammunition. And that's, you know, the Wilson administration, all of Western Europe as well, were on the side of the Reds, and they consistently were. Now, of course, you know, unless they did something to irritate the Jews. So, for example, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was passed in the U.S. because the Soviets weren't allowing Jews to immigrate to Israel. All of a sudden, the Soviet Union is a big problem now. You know, but that's the foundation of any disagreement, not any abstract condemnation of Marxism or Bolshevism, which no one in America understood.
So it's all fake, this fighting against them. I think the Baltic states discovered that, and Hungary and Bulgaria and various other countries that tried to stage an uprising and thought that the West would help them if they did, only the West didn't end up helping them. I mean, I think democracy, when you look at democracy, it's just a less extreme form of Bolshevism. You think about Bolshevism, it's basically taking everything off the rich, taking everything off the intellectuals, killing the rich, killing the priests, taking everything for the mob. And when you think of what democracy is, it's the same thing. It's getting rid of all excellence and putting everything to the decision of the majority. The majority is always going to be inferior to the minority. The minority is always going to be the elite, and the majority is always going to be just the average, or worse. You know, the actual elite type of people, the elite geniuses, are a tiny minority. So democracy in itself is just a milder form of this Bolshevism. which is taking everything and supposedly giving it to the peasants and the peasant class, which, if they actually did that, would mean the destruction of everything, because you haven't got the intelligence to run everything. The peasants know how to run the peasant things. They don't know how to run the more technical things. But that wasn't what it was. What it was taking it off of everybody and handing it over to these Jewish bankers. This is the thing. Communism was supposed to be against capitalism, yet it could never have existed without the big capitalist bankers that were funding it.
That's right. During the Civil War, the Bolshevik slogan was peace, land, and bread. Now, what they meant by this was that they were going to pull Russia out of the war and there'd be no more conflict. And yet Trotsky was talking about permanent revolution. He needed constant conflict. And Lenin understood this. They needed kulaks. They needed anybody they could to justify the existence of the state. So that was a lie. Land implied they were willing to give land to the peasantry. Well, we know that it was collectivized, and the only person who owned land was the state. And bread, they're going to feed everybody because of this. And yet the Soviet Union was on the verge of starvation its entire existence. This is a country that fed the world under the czars, even under Tsar Nicholas II. It was an equal to the U.S. in terms of grain production. It was feeding the planet. And yet, you know, 50 years, 60 years of Marxism, they were still on the verge of starvation. So everything these people said was a lie. And don't forget, both Marx and Trotsky were journalists in the West. They worked for newspapers. Marx worked for the International Herald Tribune. And I think Trotsky worked for the New York Post. So, you know, obviously there's no real problem there from the journalist point of view. And so the establishment, the elites, they rhapsodized about the USSR. There's no question, especially before World War II. Now, there came a point in maybe the late 60s, early 70s, where the capital investments in the Soviet Union were getting old. The resources really weren't there to upgrade them to a great extent. It was older style, heavy industry, you know, steel and oil and everything else. Profits were going down. Public morale was going down. All of a sudden, you know, the Jews disengage from Bolshevism. All of a sudden, you find Jews in the gulag. There was no more money to be extracted from the Soviet economy as capital is getting older and older and older, and the transport network is getting older and starting to fall apart. So then by the 1970s, the Jews had – in the 1980s, the Jews had largely disengaged from the Soviet Union, and also because of the ban on Jews traveling to Israel, became anti-Soviet. And so – and that had a lot to do with the fall of the USSR just a few years later. So they extracted – and then adding insult to injury, the Jewish elite, and almost exclusively Jewish elite, liquidated what was left of the economy in the early 90s and kept it for themselves. So they were screwed by the Jews at least three times.
Well, that's the amazing thing, really. You would think if a people group would take over a country with all the resources like Russia, and they were going to be making all the money from it, they would invest in it and they would make as much possible money as they could, and the economy would thrive, and not just the people at the top would have a high living standard, but the people underneath would have a high living standard. But instead of that, they just destroyed the country. They just destroyed the whole of Russia and all the countries that it was a part of, and killed loads of people. This is the bit that we don't understand as white people, I think, is why would anybody do that? And yet they would do that because that's the way they are. That's just the way they are. They think of us in that way. That's what we're there for. We're there to be conquered and destroyed. And we are there to resist against that and fight against it. And the other bit go on.
Eustace Mullins published a book called The Biological Jew. And it's an excellent book. It's very interesting. It's not cited a lot, even by fans of his. And it's an analysis of how a parasite functions. Because the parasite biologically speaking, is also paradoxical because it's going to kill the host. And he goes through a whole lot of parallels between Jewish politics and the biology of the parasite. And it's actually incredible. So it's all part of the same biological idea. The parasite kills the host that's made it fat. And the same thing here, especially since they had the U.S. also to go to. And so they got every penny they could. I mean, when the Bolsheviks took over, a command economy implies that the party owns everything. You can't have a command economy unless the party owns all capital. That meant a handful of mostly Jewish elites, including under Stalin. Stalin was not anti-Semitic. That's all nonsense. He surrounded himself with Jews. I have a podcast on that too. You know, owns the productive capacity of every single Soviet citizen. And what they did was take, you know, a short-term mentality. They took what they could, and then when it was, you know, got too old and creaky, they liquidated it. And that's really the history of the Soviet Union. And this is why in Ukraine and Russia, anti-Jewish thinking is mainstream. You know, you hear it on the Duma floor, you hear it on the street corners. It's not like here. There is not an anti-Holocaust denial law in Russia, contrary to myth. I read that in the original. It's a stupid law. No one's ever been prosecuted under it. It just says you can't deny the Red Army's role in defeating Germany in World War II. That's really what it's about. It's about dishonoring the soldiers. It's about dishonoring veterans. It's like a flag burning law in the U.S. It's pretty much at that level. Not one person's been prosecuted under it at all. And that's come up recently, and I want to clear that up too. There is no such thing, because Holocaust denial is mainstream. You hear it everywhere. Because Russians, more than any of the other people in the world, Ukrainians too, know what the biological Jew is. And it's very important to us.
I think the war forms a central part of their nation building mythos. So to attack that and to attack Russia's role in it, I guess they see that as subversive and being sent from abroad. I know the book you were talking about, the Eustace Mullins one. I've done a series of narrations on that. But the second point I wanted to ask you about is, you know, we could see this was going on after the Second World War. You could see the harm and the damage that communism did to the country. So how did it get exported to Africa, China, Vietnam, all these other countries? How come they took on communism? And still today, when we look at Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, he's taking everything to give to people who have no idea of how to farm. And you still have it in North Korea and China. So how did that come about? How did it become exported to these other countries? Why did they accept it?
Well, the Third World, I'm not sure if they accepted Leninism. The Third World throughout the Cold War, after World War II, played the U.S. off against the Soviet Union. Who will give them the better deal? And if the country was of military significance, like Ethiopia, very, very strategically located, or South Africa, or Angola. They made a very sweet deal. And unlike the Americans, there were no political preconditions. Most of the time in the Third World, these were just military dictatorships that, you know, said how wonderful Lenin is once in a while. And that's pretty much it. These, you know, they weren't ideological Marxists. The Derg in Ethiopia that killed the emperor there. I can't think of the dictator's name now, who actually lives in Zimbabwe. You know, wasn't a doctrinaire Marxist. He just was supported militarily by the USSR. They gave an excellent deal to them, both economically and militarily, without any political preconditions. You know, you didn't have to have free trade, like, you know, if you were going to be an American client. So I'm not saying that this is, you know, it's not really exporting Leninism. It's just a military dictatorship that borrows some of the imagery of the early Soviet Union. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, it certainly does seem different what they have in China and what they have in North Korea. And you know, China seems to be doing quite well. It's not like the country's being destroyed, although they did go through a period with killing all the birds, I believe, or something, and they did kill lots of people. But now they seem to have some kind of functioning form of it. So I guess they never really took on the Bolshevik style of communism. They just went with that, with the East, basically, because they didn't have all the restrictions that America and the West are still trying to push onto countries in Africa, like trying to push homosexuality on Nigeria and around the world. So I guess you could say that Russia is still one of the ones that doesn't actually have so many restrictions if they're going to invest money in the country. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up about communism, Matt, before we finish?
Well, I mean, do you have 8 hours? I mean, you know, there's so much to say, but I want to reiterate that, you know, we've criticized Trump in the past. You know, he's not a dictator. He can only do what Congress tells him to do. And yet stuff like this, albeit symbolic, it's a new order out there now. This would have been – even the Reagan administration never issued anything like this. Nixon never issued anything like this. And Nixon's one of the few presidents who actually did know what Bolshevism was. It's good news, and I think the left is going to have a few heads exploding, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, we have to give credit where credit is due, and we can definitely give Donald Trump credit for that. Matt, thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Boat Sinker. So until then, hail victory.
Listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.